Good afternoon. My name is Jim Proctor. I'm a faculty member here in the Department of Geography, and I'm also the project director for Science, Religion, and the Human Experience. I would like to thank all of you for your participation in this second lecture of our three-year Templeton Research Lecture Series on the constructive engagement of science and religion. Today, Jeffrey Russell, Professor Emeritus in History, speaks on constructing cosmos, science, religion, history, and reality. Our program seeks to shed scholarly light on the ways that science and religion are embedded in, yet seek to transcend, the historical, political, psychological, and other contexts defining the human experience. If you would like more information about our program, we do have some brochures available outside. There is an email announcement list you may sign up for outside. We also have a website, www.srhe.ucsb.edu. On the website, you will find, for the lectures, the text of each lecture and online video available and an online web forum for you to discuss the lectures after they occur. There is also information available online and outside of the tables on ordering VHS copies of each of the lectures. I'd like quickly to note we have two upcoming lectures this spring. First, Freeman Dyson of Princeton's Institute for Advanced Studies speaks on May 18th in Broida 1610 on technology and social justice. And secondly, Alan Wallace speaks on June 1st in Corwin Pavilion, the intersubjective worlds of science and religion. And that's just the beginning. We have fully 18 lectures scheduled over the next 2 years. Now, if you attended last week's presentation by Walter Cohn, you know my acknowledgments took a while, and the reason is that this has certainly been a group effort. Today I'd like to cut that short, but I would like to acknowledge the efforts of the Office of Public Events in setting up our venues and logistics for the talk, the very good support of the Office of Instructional Resources in doing the TV production for these lectures, and the continuing support of the John Templeton Foundation's Templeton Research Lectures on the Constructive Engagement of Science and Religion. I now welcome Chancellor Henry Yang to the podium. We all appreciate Chancellor Yang's strong support of this research lectures program. Chancellor Yang is here to make a special dedication.
Thank you, Jim. Good afternoon and welcome here. I'm just delighted to be here today as we continue the Templeton Lecture Series on Science, Religion, and the Human Experience. We are honored to have UCSB historian Jeffrey Russell here as our distinguished speaker today. Dr. Russell will be talking to us about constructing cosmos, science, religion, history, and reality. Jeff, I still remember vividly that one night in 1995 that you were in my office. We spent a long night together talking about everything, and you were giving me an in-depth description about a definition of construction and deconstruction. You know, for an engineer with a different meaning, that's very enlightening. I really respected the depth and historical perspective you have. You are one of most respected scholars on campus. Thank you. And this is a very special series, and we are grateful to the Templeton Foundation for supporting such an important and unique program. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank Professor James Proctor for convincing the Templeton Foundation to choose UCSB as a forum for this prestigious Templeton Foundation lecture series. I also want to thank you for your excellent leadership in running this series and to get it off onto such a good start. The guiding idea behind the series is to explore the intersections where belief and knowledge connect within the human enterprise. As we talk about a guiding idea behind the Templeton Lecture Series, there's one of our faculty colleagues who would be most highly regarded as a natural and ideal speaker. But unfortunately, And sadly, he could no longer be with us physically, although he is still with us spiritually. And our beloved and respected colleague, Professor Ninian Smart. Ninian devoted his life to this kind of exploration, and now his exploration has left us with a rich legacy. Ninian was a part of our UCSB family for over a quarter of a century. He was honored by our Department of Religious Studies to be our first J.F. Ronnie Professor in a comparative study of religions, which he held until his retirement in 1998. Ninian was a pioneer in religious studies. He not only opened our eyes, he also opened our hearts and minds to an unexpected richness in a new world of religious tradition and beliefs. He was intensely interested in how religion affects every aspect of our human experience. Ninian was a wonderful teacher, a creative administrator, a scholar of the greatest breadth and depth, a prolific author, a wise philosopher, and a man with a rich flavor of humor. He was also our dear friend and a colleague. Professor Smart passed away in Lancaster on January 29th of this year, just 3 days after he and I bid farewell to each other in my office. It was so hard to say goodbye to him on that day, and it is even harder to say goodbye today. And today it is my great honor to dedicate the Templeton series to the memory of Ninian Smart. Professor Wade Clark Roof is with us to accept this plaque on behalf of Ninian's wife, Libushka. And let me read this plaque to you. It says, R. Ninian Smart, 1927-2001. Distinguished scholar and a teacher of the philosophy of religions and the comparative study of religions, whose work expanded our understanding of religion and world views and of their importance in human experience. Department of Religious Studies, 1976-1998. And I understand Lubushka wants this plaque to be hung on the wall of the department rather than at her home. And I just can't think of no better memorial to Ninian than such a vital and provocative series. And thank you so much for joining us for this dedication ceremony.
Thank you, Chancellor Yang. I did, in fact, speak with Lubushka Smart just yesterday, and she was so enormously pleased to know that these lectures had been dedicated to the memory of Ninian. And yes, it was her request. I offered to send this very beautiful plaque to her, but it was her request that we keep it here as part of the Department of Religious Studies. I think this is a very deserving tribute to Ninian Smart. Not only was he on the planning committee in the fall as we sought to put together these lectures, throughout Ninian's scholarly work, he was always interested in some broad definition of religion. In fact, he preferred the term worldview. And he always included within that examples of science and nationalism and political ideology and broad, encompassing worldviews, which he felt were absolutely essential to study. So for him, religion was never some isolated, very narrow definition. It was always something very, very broad. He would be delighted, I'm sure, to know that we are carrying on this series and that we're exploring the topics of religion and science and the human experience. So on behalf of the Smart family, I'm very pleased to accept this, and I will acknowledge it in writing and with a picture of the plaque to Lubushka Smart. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'd now like to welcome Professor Richard Hecht, professor and former chair, Department of Religious Studies, who will introduce today's speaker.
Thank you. Executive Vice Chancellor Eileen Nagel set a very high standard for those of us who have been asked to introduce the lecturers in this newly named or dedicated SMART series on science, religion, and the human experience. Executive Vice Chancellor Nagel quoted Hebrew and Aramaic. You remember that? I was pretty impressed by that. In introducing Walter Cohen, the first speaker in the series. And indeed, she was correct, as all of us know. Walter has been a blessing to all of those around him. So, for the past week, I've been shaking literally in my shoes until I decided that I would introduce my colleague of now 22 years, Jeffrey Russell, by quoting a Latin text which is attributed to none other than Nicholas of Cusa, who was born in 1401 and died in 1464. This text is preserved by Giordano Bruno and Blaise Pascal in the 16th and 17th centuries, respectively. And it reads in Latin, Sphaera cuia centrum ubique, circumferentia nullibi, or in my rough English translation, the universe has its center everywhere, ubique, and its circumference nowhere, nullibi. Nicholas of Cusa was one of the most important late medieval thinkers who tried to reconcile a mystical understanding of the cosmos with the science of his day. Indeed, his understanding of what he called absolute emptiness was to reverberate for nearly 200 years in Jewish mystical thought and also in Christian physics. Nicholas of Cusa knew that the dialogue between science and religion was staked on a conception of the cosmos. And from his cosmography, he deduced his physics and metaphysics, and on the basis of that, his own effort to reconcile faith and reason. Jeffrey Russell also recognizes the primacy of cosmos in the dialogue that we are engaged in between science and religion. I have known Jeffrey Russell for 22 years, since he was appointed to our faculty in 1979. Over the course of his career, he has brought considerable renown to our Department of History and indeed our entire campus. I remember in 1979 that he joined then C. Warren Hollister, one of the most distinguished medievalists of the United States. And the two of them built what is now an acclaimed program in medieval history and medieval studies. They built it around their scholarship and their teaching. And most importantly, I think, in bringing to this campus a group of younger scholars who would continue their impeccable tradition of research and teaching. Professor Russell has written over 15 books since his first Descent and Reform in the Early Middle Ages in 1965. He has been particularly interested in the history of the problem of evil, as all of you know. And his The Devil, Perceptions of Evil from Antiquity to Primitive Christianity in 1977, and then Satan, the Early Christian Tradition in 1981, then Lucifer, The Devil in the Middle Ages in 1984, and then Mephistopheles, The Devil in the Modern World in 1986, and then finally, The Prince of Darkness, Evil and the Power of Good in History in 1986. Of course, one form of recognition for scholarship on this topic is among the believers. And I must briefly tell you that I was once flying back from a professional meeting, I can't remember which it was, but I was seated next to a man who was wearing moose and black before they were fashionable. I noticed that he was reading Professor Russell's The Prince of Darkness. Now, you know, some of you who know me remember that I always try to be friendly. And you're stuck on the plane with someone for 3 or 5 hours. You've all had this experience. You want to sort of strike up a conversation. So at one point, I said, "Do you like that book?" The man said, "What a stupid question. This is the greatest book I've ever read." And between you and me on this plane right here, I'm into Satan. You know, and they continued, "This Russell fellow has it right," whatever that meant. I didn't feel like asking the stewardess for a change of seating, upgrade, sort of intercontinental upgrade. But I later learned from my companion as we were sitting there that he was a part of Wicca, the modern religious movement which has sought to reclaim pre-Christian traditions of Europe. And among some of them, the Satan is important. So, by the end of the 1980s, Russell's work had become part of a canon of Wiccan religiosity. But of course, his scholarship has been recognized in other ways. He was made the Academic Senate's faculty research lecturer, and that is the highest honor bestowed by the Academic Senate on its teaching faculty. But I also know another side of Jeffrey Russell, and that is that Jeffrey Russell who is an extraordinary teacher. 5 years ago, Jeffrey and I offered a graduate seminar on the history of heaven in the Jewish and Christian traditions from late antiquity to the early modern world. I will never, Jeffrey, forget the two-part seminar and reading you gave of Dante. The subtitle of Jeffrey's History of Heaven, as all of you know, is The Singing Silence. That was one of the most extraordinary experiences I've ever had as a student. Jeffrey's, Professor Russell's, reading and interpretation of Dante. Of course, portions of that seminar later became part of his magnificent book, A History of Heaven, The Singing Silence, in 1997. Now, I asked myself, what makes him such a distinguished historian? In many respects, he does what all historians do. He shows us change. Sometimes small change. I don't mean the kind you keep in your pocket, by the way. Small change, transformations. And sometimes transformations of much greater magnitude. But what he has done so successfully in his books, and in more than 100 chapters, essays, and articles, is to show how religion changes, and how religion changes history and culture. All of his work is about a dialogue between religion and historical cultures. Russell may agree or disagree with Nicholas of Cusa about the center of the universe. Is it anywhere or nowhere? Perhaps Cusa and Einstein might have much to say to one another, but what is certain is that Professor Russell's lecture this afternoon, Constructing Cosmos, Science, History, and Reality, will continue our discussion about the relationship of these zones of human creativity, science, and religion. Please welcome now Jeffrey Russell.
Richard, I want to thank you for that really too kind introduction. It's very moving. And I really appreciate it. And I've appreciated being here at UCSB with all of you for the past 22 years. And although I'm retired, I still do sneak into my office at the cover of night and do a few things once in a while. Science seems to me to teach in the highest and strongest manner the great truth which is embodied in the conception of entire surrender to the will of God. Sit down before fact as a little child. Be prepared to give up every preconceived notion. Follow humbly wherever and to whatever abysses nature leads, or you shall learn nothing. That very good advice is from Thomas Huxley, the great English biologist of the 19th century. And we need it at this difficult stage in the life of our civilization. When I sit, as Huxley suggested, and look at cosmos today, I see it deeply wounded, not only split between science and religion, but torn into 1,000 different concerns. We need healing, which brings health, which brings wholeness, which brings holiness, which brings, well, cosmos. The word cosmos means order and purpose. Without order and purpose, there is only chaos in the original sense, gaping, yawning void. Order and purpose imply intelligence, and with all the respect due to the late Carl Sagan, no purpose, no cosmos. By cosmos, I mean two different things. By K-cosmos, I mean the whole cosmos, physical, mental, and spiritual, as it actually is. Not something we construct, but as it, to use the word objectively, as it objectively is. The K-cosmos just is, with absolute isness. Now, extraordinary work is being done at UCSB by our previous lecturer, Walter Cohn, and his colleagues at the ITP, work that has the potential of constructing a coherent explanation of part of K-cosmos, that is to say, its physical nature. And that is stunningly promising. But K-cosmos, the cosmos as it really is more than its physical nature. K-cosmos as a whole cannot be known. That is, there is no M-cosmos that can exhaust or plumb the depths of K-cosmos. But K-cosmos can be figured by metaphor in M-cosmos, and more on metaphor in a while. We do not have the power to construct K-cosmos, the cosmos as it is, in itself, but we can construct M-cosmos. M-cosmos is our mental construct of the whole K-cosmos, physical and spiritual, including our own thoughts and feelings. Mental constructs are made out of concepts. Concepts have always been diverse and difficult to fit together, but in the past century, so much so that M-cosmos has been virtually torn apart. It is M-cosmos that I mourn for. And before I go on, that last term, metaphorical ontology, I'm going to use later on in the speech, and I put it up there only because it's an unfamiliar term. I'm going to recur to it later. Now, lately, people in many fields have been hoping to construct a new M-cosmos. And what I'm doing today is simply suggesting some approaches through history and metaphor. Some approaches is an important phrase, not just because we haven't yet got a complete M-cosmos, but because a true M-cosmos is never closed. It's always opening up, becoming more beautiful, more expansive and elegant, more fascinating and intriguing. It is both and thinking more than either or thinking. Now, both and thinking does not exclude either or thinking. Either or is a form of argument proper to problems that have been closely defined and that think a definitive answer, such as the mass of strange quarks. I'm not arguing anything today, because as soon as we pass beyond such well-defined problems to the nature of the K-cosmos as a whole, either or is often obstructive rather than constructive. Much of the alleged warfare between science and religion today is based on pointless either-or oppositions. The motto of the discussion today is both and more, and still more. The history of concepts is a peculiarly effective way of describing religion and science. History works differently from either science or religion. History explains events by recounting, as in a traditional story, how we got from point A to point C by going through process B. For example, we got to today's Russia by going from the Russia of the Tsars through the Bolsheviks and Yeltsin to Putin. History assumes the reality of persons in the past, including their thoughts, the reality of persons in the past, including their thoughts and their feelings and their whole personalities. No one is a dead white man or a dead anybody. To think so is to misunderstand the nature of time. When is now? As we reflect on our lives back to, say, our 10th birthday, did we think at age 10 that we were really in the past and that the real now is being in this room on the 27th of April, 2001? And what we think on the 28th of April, that we are at last in the future? Now, where you were, when you were 10 is now. When this talk is going on is now. And tomorrow is now. Now is almost an infinitesimal point moving across time, so that all moments are now. It follows that Bach, or Sappho, or Confucius, or Ninian Smart, or Gandhi, are no less alive than we are today. Everyone is alive. Everyone's personality is real. Everyone is now. History is never concerned with the dead past, always with the living encounter with persons living now. The history of concepts takes ideas seriously as having real consequences, and this point probably will the reason I'm making this point is because some people dispute that today. But anyone who thinks that ideas do not have real consequences might talk with a Holocaust survivor about the reality of Hitler's ideas. But what are concepts? Well, they're what people have believed them to be. Religion and science are not rigid, eternal, unchanging Platonic ideas. There are concepts that continue to change through time. And history explains how science and religion came to be what they are today, or rather, in any given person's mind today, because any given person's personal cosmos is explained through their own personal history as well as through the history of their society. Now, since my personal cosmos is a deep part of my M cosmos, I need to mince no words. I am a Christian. Now, that I am a Christian does not mean that I submit to authority. My children say that I taught them to question authority, even became a bumper sticker. I questioned the authority of the bishops, the president, the doctor, and the New York Times. I do not believe this or that because I am a Christian. In fact, I was raised an atheist. Just the other way around, I am a Christian because I believe this or that. A great deal of learning consists of unlearning the caricatures and cliches about other people's beliefs that we are taught as children by our parents, teachers, and peers. And one example is the myth that people used to believe that the earth was flat. We all have a lot of unlearning to do, especially about the all-time big problem, with capital B and P, big problem in bringing science and religion together, namely, God. Many people who draw near to a deep view of cosmos recoil at the brink because they cannot help thinking of the guy in the sky. They reject any idea of God. And it may help to replace the word God with an old Greek usage, the God, instead. Oddly, the addition of the definite article makes the term more indefinite and more universal. Religious experience and religious expression are almost universal among humans. Experience ought not to be denied without powerful evidence against it, and it would be rash to assume that religious experience is false or illusory. If the brain is wired for it, as some have very recently argued, why should it be? How could an illusion be adaptive? Religion has the strong advantage of admitting the mystery that the K-cosmos is much deeper and more complex than we can ever understand. It has the strong disadvantage of appearing to be self-contradictory, with one religion canceling out another. But actually, when properly understood, as Ninian Smart did, when properly understood through metaphor, they do not cancel one another out. Religion is, at its best, not a zero-sum game where we are right and deserve to win and they are wrong and deserve to lose. Religion can open us up to the astounding richness and variety of reality, both and. Science is an effort to understand physical reality through theory, mathematics, and especially rigorous experimentation. The first citation of the English word science occurs in 1340, at which time it meant learning or knowledge in general. Not before 1725 did science mean an orderly, systematic system based on observation and mathematics. The history of the language is not just a curiosity, it's a strong clue to concepts, the way we look at things. The human mind is constructed in such a way that once we have a concept, a word follows for it very quickly. And the lack of a word may mean that there is as yet no cosmos for it to express. So the concept of science apart from other knowledge could not have much predated the appearance of the word science in 1725. Well, were Galileo and Newton not scientists? Well, in an important way, they were not. The word scientist doesn't appear before 1834. Although there were people doing things that look like what we call today science, no one thought of himself in the category of a scientist. They thought of their subject as natural philosophy instead. Natural philosophy. And the distinction is important because they thought of natural philosophy as an integral part of philosophy, a system of understanding the whole, in other words, an M cosmos. The title of Newton's key work is The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, 1686-87. When the term physics first appears in 1589, it meant all knowledge of nature as a whole, and not before 1715 did it mean knowledge specifically of matter and energy, and no one called himself a physicist before 1840. In some senses, there were no physicists before 1840. There are some ways in which physicists existed before anyone thought that he was, but in some senses not. What if someone in 2501 should classify you in some term that you've never heard of? The origins of modern science, of course, lie in the unparalleled innovations made in the 6th to 4th centuries BCE by Greek philosophers, who were the first to ask, what simple material principle underlies the variety of natural phenomena that we observe? The search for the one principle which explains everything characterizes Western natural philosophy from the 6th century BCE to physical cosmology today. The Greeks also created an enduring dichotomy in philosophy. Some Greek philosophers before Plato were materialists and monists, the precursors of modern material reductionists. Leucippus and Democritus argued that all phenomena were made of an infinitesimal, indivisible particles called atoms, from Greek atomos, indivisible. To the contrary, Plato argued that reality is purely mathematical and ideal, and only secondarily, and to him not very interestingly, physical. The physical appearances of objects, such as this podium, and their motion could be assigned causes by hypothesis. But these hypotheses were not to be confused with actual reality, which was incorporeal form and pure idea. And this dichotomy between materialism and idealism would underlie the condemnation of Galileo 2 millennia later. Aristotle tried to bridge the gap. All material substances, he thought, are composed of two elements, matter and form. Both matter and form are real, but are not found independent of one another. Aristotle's view of astronomy needs mention here because we will return to it later in Dante. The world is constructed, for Aristotle, in concentric circles centered on the sphere of the earth, a geometrically perfect Platonic idea, though Aristotle was well aware that he had to explain the apparently irregular motion of the planets, the irregular motion of the planets. Their recession, a phenomenon that he did not believe was merely appearance but physically real, and the poor man with the system had to come up with 55 planetary spheres in order to figure out the motion of the planets as they appear to us. Now, the great Christian bishop, Augustine, who died in 451, did more to construct M. Cosmos, including religion and science, than anyone before Dante. And he was the most important person before Einstein in developing the conception of time. Time is real. It has a beginning. Before creation, there was no time. Time and space began at the moment of creation. The God created the cosmos perfect, but it was disrupted by our free will choice to do our own will rather than the God's. The God chooses to save the world from the consequences of our wrong use of free will, but he does not do so immediately. This is really important, because rather he does so by using time in a series of salvation events: the revelation to Moses, the saving revelation through Christ, and finally, the return of the Messiah at the end of the world. So here, unlike the idea of time in most cultures, here we have time is not only real, but directional, and it's morally purposive. Here's the origin of the modern notion of progress, and something like history looks in at the door. We get from A through B to C. Augustine strongly encouraged natural philosophy. The God creates the cosmos. In Greek, he makes it. In Greek, poieo, to make, means to create not only in a physical sense, but also in a metaphorical sense. A poet, poieo, to make, poietes, a maker. A poet is a maker as much as an engineer is. Since the God made everything, everything has meaning and purpose. We have access to two great books of revelation. One is the Bible, and the other is the book of nature. The two, far from being incompatible, are both given to us for our understanding. To understand the God, we do three basic things. We look within ourselves, we look to the God as revealed in the Bible, and we look at the book of nature revealed in the physical world around us. Augustine would have thought what we call science a holy activity. Medieval philosophers used natural philosophy to help construct an M cosmos pointing toward the ultimate truth that is the God. The emphasis of medieval theology, Jewish and Muslim, as well as Christian, was on the moral and spiritual aspects of the cosmos rather than on the physical. Natural philosophy was less important in itself than as a means to understanding ultimate reality. Medieval thinkers thus had a global community of purpose, leading them to construct a complete M cosmos. By the beginning of the 12th century, Western Christian thinkers began to question authority and to criticize tradition. The first great shocking thought came from St. Anselm of Canterbury, who died in 1109, who argued that reason alone, unaided by revelation, could demonstrate the existence of the God. Reason without revelation can demonstrate the existence of the God. The next great intellectual shock was that of Abelard, who died in 1142, who wrote a book called Yes and No, containing an implicit criticism of tradition. He didn't quite dare say it, but he chose a number of philosophical and theological questions and cited church fathers on both sides of every issue. The implications were frightening. Perhaps past authorities could be wrong. Perhaps natural reason could be used to criticize those authorities. And perhaps such methods might one day be applied to the Bible. By the middle of the 12th century, Abelard's queries had led to a new method called dialectic. A thesis was stated, then its antithesis, the other side, and then, through the use of reason, a synthesis. This dialectic, without which much of modern philosophy would have been impossible, was the core of the medieval scholastic method. No longer could a question be answered by simply citing a traditional view from the church fathers or from Aristotle. The difference is enormous. Now, the people who were making this kind of progress, if we want to call it that, certainly kind of great change, were almost exclusively clergymen. But on the other hand, a number of bishops feared that such critical thinking would undermine their own authority. And that was perhaps a base motive. But they had a good motive as well. They understood that a principle vital to the whole life of the Christian church was at stake. That is the principle of apostolic succession. The truth of Christianity was based on the principle that the bishops hold authority because they are successors of the apostles. The bishops feared that university professors, amazing fear, often prefer their own rational explanations to apostolic authority. We never do that. There was also an honest theological worry when academics argued that academic formulas were true in a real and absolute sense, that they encapsulated absolute reality, K cosmos, they were skirting a blasphemous equation of M cosmos with K cosmos. And again, this problem underlay the Galileo problem later. Now, in the next century, in the 14th century, appeared the most perfect M cosmos to date, incorporating current ideas of philosophy, theology, and natural philosophy. This was Dante's Paradiso, the least appreciated, but most intellectually and aesthetically satisfying book of the Divine Comedy. Uniting the Bible with Christian tradition and natural philosophy, Dante's work shows how both theology and science permeated the thought of highly educated people in the 14th century. His geographical and astronomical accuracy is astounding. For example, it was no mean feat in his day to calculate the exact position of the sun at the same moment in latitudes and even longitudes as different as Italy and Jerusalem. For Dante, the truest picture and deepest meaning of the K cosmos was ethical, not physical. Here's a key point. Dante's physical universe, that is his E cosmos, though, his construction of the physical universe, Dante's construction of the physical universe is a metaphor for the ethical cosmos rather than the other way around. See, we assume so much in our time that it's the physical that's real, and anything the spiritual or mental things or concepts are metaphors, pardon me, for the physical. But Dante's assumption is the other way around. The physical universe is a metaphor for the ethical cosmos rather than the other way around. Now, Dante's universe was arranged in an Aristotelian series of concentric spheres, the Earth being the sphere at the center. Nobody thought it was flat. It's a sphere at the center. Above and around the sphere was the sphere of the Moon. And then in order, those of Mercury and Venus and the Sun. And if you think about it, you'll understand why. If the Earth is at the center, the Sun has to be in the orbit between Venus and Mars. That's where we would be in a heliocentric system. And then beyond that, the spheres of Jupiter, Saturn, and the fixed stars. Of course, they had no notion of the movement of the stars. They appeared to be exactly in the same place at all times. And then, finally, the final sphere is the primum mobile. And beyond the primum mobile, natural philosophy could not go. You can talk about natural philosophy up to there. Beyond that, you can't go. What is the primum mobile? It's a sphere which moves all the spheres below it down to the tiny Earth at the center. But the primum mobile has no depth in itself. It is the dimensionless skin of the entire cosmos. Now, Dante and the Paradiso, Dante and his readers progress upward from the center of the universe, from the Earth, through all of those concentric spheres throughout the entire Paradiso, until we get to the outermost and highest sphere, the primum mobile. Now, Dante stands at a point on the primum mobile, looking down at the tiny Earth far below through all those spheres. And beyond the primum mobile, what is there? There's nothing. Nothing at all. I'd cut Nicholas of Cusa out of the lecture, but since Richard brought him up, I've got to put him back in here. Yes, it's a wonderful insight. The cosmos has its center nowhere and its boundaries. It has its boundaries nowhere, has its boundaries nowhere and its center everywhere. So beyond the primum mobile is nothing, yet beyond it is the God. And now Dante thrillingly, metaphorically turns his head away. He's standing there looking down at Earth, and he turns his head away in the opposite direction from all those spheres and the Earth at their center. And thrillingly, he turns and looks through the primum mobile and sees nothing. Now, there he is. There's Dante standing at the outermost, at the primum mobile, which is the outermost circle. But now you see what's happened. There's an enormous inversion that's taken place. He turns and looks through the primum mobile on to the other side, and I just want to completely squash the incredible beauty of this change with a holy metaphor. What's happening here is like turning a ball, taking a ball and turning it inside out. Suddenly the outside has become the inside. Now, as soon as he puts his head through the skin of the primum mobile to look at the God's heaven, a great inversion occurs. Now he can, by looking in the other direction, see down and up, same thing now, through the spheres that circle the blazing point of the God. So he's turning around in the other direction. He's looking down through a series of spheres now in the other direction, and at the center of that is God. Is it up or down? Well, it's both. The direction is down, up, it's out, it's in, all at once. Where is that blazing point of the God? It's nowhere. Nowhere in space-time. And it's everywhere. It's beyond the cosmos, yet it is the source and ground of being of the entire cosmos. Dante is looking into a, quote, place, a non-place, which is also a place and not a place, where there is no dimension, time, or space. Physically, it's not the universe at all. And yet, morally, it is the center of the universe. See, now here we have, that's the other direction down to Earth. If you were to go turn around, you could see right back down through our physical cosmos to Earth. But Dante is now looking at the blazing center. It's the moral center of the universe. It both contains and exceeds all time and space. It is everywhere and every when. It is here, now, always. Back to history. In the 16th century, cracks in this magnificent M cosmos appeared. The Protestant Reformation broke the consensus on the authority of the bishops, removing one obstacle to M cosmos. But the Reformation created new ones. Protestants emphasized the overt literal reading of the Bible, which oversimplified the Bible and narrowed it down instead of opening it up to the rich multiplicity of understanding. For overt literalists, a narrative is either an historical or scientific record, or it's a symbolical representation. It cannot be both. But it is both and. Insistence on the overt meaning of Scripture led eventually to the unnecessary conflict over evolution. We set up these dichotomies, both either or, when we should be thinking in terms of both and. Now, to the most famous case, of course, Galileo. With Galileo, differences between religion and science emerged. Galileo confirmed Copernicus' heliocentric theory that the sun's got to be seen in the center of the solar system. He confirmed it by experiment using a new device, the telescope. In 1609-1610, he observed the phases of Venus and discovered the moons of Jupiter, phenomena that could be explained by the old systems of Aristotle or Ptolemy, but only by the most complex contortions. It was much simpler, much more elegant to have the sun at the center rather than the earth. Now, Galileo seems not to have had any intention of denying that the Bible was revealed or rejecting Christian tradition. Pope Urban VIII initially respected his views and granted him significant public honors. But in 1632, Galileo made a brave but politically inept move in his book Dialogue on the Two Chief World Systems. Galileo, who would have found the medieval scholastics congenial, imagine him talking with Nicholas of Cusa, having a good old time, but he had no use for their pedantic and ossified successors in the 17th century, simply repeating what they had heard in the past. So in this dialogue, he created the character of Simplicio, the simple guy, the dumbhead, to represent dusty old Aristotelian scholasticism against empirical natural philosophy. Even so, the dialogue received an imprimatur from the Pope, and initially it was well received, but it also created for Galileo, obviously, a lot of enemies. Even most of those supporting him wished to keep the traditional distinction between hypothesis on the one hand and underlying absolute truth on the other. A wonderful idea, this heliocentric system with its planets and moons, so long as we understand that it's a theoretical hypothesis and not an effort at describing absolute reality or K-cosmos. But Galileo insisted that if a hypothesis saves all the appearances, it is identical with truth. Now, a struggle commenced between those clergy who supported Galileo and those furious with him. The furious prevailed, and in 1633, the papal inquisition suppressed the dialogue. Now, the condemnation was political, primarily political, but it also had important intellectual bases. It did not condemn the idea that the sun is the center of the solar system. What it did condemn was Galileo's view that natural reason applied through mathematics and observation of phenomena can provide a truth independent of that of theology. And, you know, you can understand their point, because though Galileo did not intend it, he was implicitly proposing a divorce between science and religion, the creation of a natural philosophy independent of theological philosophy. The Book of Nature was separate from the Book of Revelation. Galileo cracked medieval cosmos. It was all in pieces, all coherence gone. The implications of Galileo and his contemporaries were becoming manifest, especially the shift from looking at natural phenomena as an overlay of an actual ideal reality to seeing the phenomena, physical phenomena and events, as actual reality itself. And taken altogether, that scientific revolution of the 17th century amounted to the replacement of a coherent organic world by a mechanical world of lifeless matter, incessant local motion, and random collision. Whatever the intent of Galileo or his opponents, the affair had almost unbounded effect upon subsequent thought. In the 19th century, a curious idea became fixed. Most educated people today would, in a true or false quiz, answer true to the following statement. A great war between science and religion has been raging for centuries, beginning with Galileo, if not before. The small amount of truth contained in that caricature is outweighed by what's false, because religion usually has supported rather than resisted science, And the very idea of a warfare between science and religion was invented in the mid-19th century. The opening barrage of that war came from John W. Draper, who died in 1882. He wrote A History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. It was the first mention of such a thing. He wrote, "The antagonism we witness between religion and science is the continuation of the struggle that commenced when Christianity began to attain political power. A divine revelation must necessarily be intolerant of contradiction. It must repudiate all improvement in itself and view with disdain improvement arising from the progressive intellectual development of man. The history of science is not a mere record of isolated discoveries. It is a narrative of the conflict of two contending powers, the expansive force of the human intellect on one side and the compression arising from traditional faith and human interests on the other. The fall of Rome left religious affairs to take their place, and accordingly those affairs fell into the hands of ignorant and infuriated ecclesiastics, parasites, eunuchs, and slaves." Well, okay, there we have either or. Okay. The myth of the flat earth, appearing in the 18th century, perhaps earlier, is an example of the preposterous caricatures used by Draper and his followers. One of the platitudes that everybody knows about the Middle Ages is that medieval people thought that the earth was flat. But no educated person in the Middle Ages thought so. The myth of the flat earth would have faded if the Drapers had not used it to bludgeon their opponents by claiming that they were just as stupid as the alleged medieval people who allegedly thought that the earth was flat. Now, biological evolution became the battleground in which the standards of warfare were raised and are still being brandished. No story in science, even the Galileo affair, is more fixed in the public consciousness, at least in America, than the Scopes trial. In the late 18th and early 19th century, the idea that the geological and biological features of Earth today are the products of change through time had been gaining strength. This geological and biological succession of life through time is entirely compatible with theology and certainly with religion. The meaningfulness and direction of time had been established by St. Augustine. As soon as the old idea that the age of the earth was about 10,000 years was replaced by millions or billions of years, there was time galore for such succession. Some scientists objected that by the 1870s, it had become the clearly dominant scientific view. Other objections arose from unnecessary, exclusivist religious either-or views, and some Christians became part of the problem rather than part of the solution. If one assumes, first, that the Bible is without error, and second, that it must be read in an overt, literal way wherever possible, one may conclude that the account of creation in Genesis was supposed to be a literal, scientific, physical account of the beginning of the world over a short period of time. And then one ends up rejecting slow biological and geological succession through time. Now, this position provokes not only scientists and historians, but also most theologians who know that there is no such thing as reading the Bible or any other text with an absolutely blank mind and without preformed conceptions. Such a position is not necessarily for most religious people, including Christians. Most theologians over time have read the Bible as metaphorical, at least in large part. That organisms develop over vast eons of time through natural processes and with spectacular diversity is a proposition that need not provoke division. It says nothing about the God. Thus, the war over evolution was unnecessary. When, however, a number of evolutionists argued that the success of the development through time was completely without purpose or intelligent direction, then they did set it in opposition to most religions by definition. When religion is defined in a literalist fashion and evolution is defined in a reductionist fashion, the two exclude each other, basically by definition. But there is no need for such either-or positions. One of the greatest obstacles to the formation of a new cosmos in the 21st century is materialist reductionism. The ultimate origins of the idea are as old as the Greek atomists, but the first English instance of the word materialism, meaning the belief that all actions, thoughts, feelings can be reduced to material explanation, first appeared in 1748. The term reductionism, which means basically the same thing, is recent. It means that every phenomenon in the K cosmos can be reduced to matter, that there is no meaning other than the M cosmos produced by science. Now, I think it's okay to say that the study of natural phenomena may be reduced to the construction of universal physical regularities, an M cosmos, but it is not okay to assume that all truth can be reduced to physical regularities. Reductionism is either-or thinking identifiable by certain key words and phrases. You see them again and again, such as just, merely, only, nothing but. Your reaction to your favorite music is nothing but chemicals in your brain. Your mathematical ideas are chemicals in your brain. These are not caricatures. Reductionists mean what they say. From E.O. Wilson's book, Consilience, everything can be reduced to simple universal laws of physics. Ideas and feelings are merely linkage among the neural networks. It can all eventually be explained as brain circuitry. Circuitry. Everything that is knowable but not yet known to science is open to being explained by science. Are you suffering in pain or despair? Never mind, it's just your neural networks. Richard Lewontin writes, "We take the side of science because we have an a priori commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world. But on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to materialist causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." That is Lewontin. Now that is a, in my view, a creedal statement analogous to, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." There are no scientific means by which reductionists can possibly know that there is no direction or plan. Such reductionists violate a fundamental principle of science itself. Science is based upon testable hypotheses. A good hypothesis is one that can be disproved or proved. Atheist dogmas are not only not scientific, they do not even qualify as arguments because they are purely statement of faith. The faith statement that there is no God lacks evidence at least as much as a statement that there is a God. But this reductionist faith goes well beyond denying the ground of being. It denies you. Your sense of your irreducible sense, your own you-ness, is an illusion since, quote, people are just, there we are again, just extremely complicated machines. But materialism itself is an idea just as immaterial as any other idea. If no idea is better than any other idea because they all proceed from purposeless neural interaction, then the idea of reductionism itself is no better than crystal gazing. Have you ever grieved for someone you love very much? Not to worry, it's just chemicals in your brain. You want to study biology or medicine rather than watch TV all day? It's just chemicals in your brain. Is it any wonder that people today live lives of noisy desperation, seeking loudness, coarseness, and drugs as protective anodynes against the pointlessness of their lives? Ah, say the reductionists, but we can construct meaning for ourselves. But on what basis? For a logically inevitable consequence of reductionism is relativism, and the logically inevitable consequence of relativism is cynicism. If everything is equal, nothing can be precious. If no idea is better than another, then there is no basis for discourse, for reason is vacated, only power remains, and in place of discourse, shrill, accusatory, political struggles on every level and on every side. A healthy skepticism would produce humility as to our own views, sympathy with those of others, a desire to open up more and more, and above all, an unwillingness to coerce or manipulate other persons whose feelings are just as real as ours. True discourse would then be possible. In the meanwhile, the ethical results of relativism are drowning us. Reduction of all ideas to neural impulses mean that no moral or ethical concept is better than any other. Efforts to construct ethical systems without regard to moral absolutes are without ground to stand on. If no behavior is better than any other, why bother about the whales in the rainforests? What's wrong with child molesting or genocide? What's wrong with faking scientific evidence? Appeals to good sense and common decency, and surely you must agree, are simply evasions of the basic principles of reductionist thought. According to E.O. Wilson, we need the illusion of free will as biologically adaptive. We need the self-deception of altruism. But what possible good, moral, intellectual, or evolutionary, can come from belief in free will and cosmos if they're illusions and lies? Stephen Jay Gould has suggested that we all need to take a cold shower and wake up to the fact that our lives are meaningless and directionless. But though we all know people who solemnly proclaim that life is pointless and without meaning, we know few who live their lives that way. I admire him for his refusal to flinch. I admire the Marquis de Sade for his refusal to flinch from the implications of relativism. He recognized that flinching was either evasion or an indication that relativists did not believe their own proclamations. In an intrinsically relative, valueless world, Sade argued, the only sensible thing is to seek personal pleasure. If you enjoy torture, fine. If others do not enjoy it, fine, but they have no business imposing their views on you. Why should a child molester not be free to rape and torture his victims? The response that one person should impose his desires, should not impose his desires on an unwilling victim, Sade pointed out, is an assumption without any basis in relativism. Sade defined the dilemma: either there is real evil or there isn't. Either there is a ground of being by which to judge actions or there is not. Sade's arguments are the legitimate outcome of honest relativism. Once the relativist allows any principle to get its nose under the flap of his tent, he is no longer an authentic relativist. But someone went beyond Sade's nihilism. America's lovable creator of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain. Mark Twain, very complicated person. His manifesto of nihilism appears in his book number 44, The Mysterious Stranger. The Mysterious Stranger. Just extremely briefly, this mysterious stranger enters a happy village and encounters a young man whom, after many experiences, the stranger finally persuades of the validity of the stranger's beliefs. And here's what they are. Nothing exists. It's all a dream. God, man, the world, the sun, the moon, the wilderness of stars, a dream, a dream. They have no existence. Nothing exists save empty space and you. And you, you are not you. You have no body, no blood, no bones. You are but a thought. I myself have no existence. I am only a dream, your dream. Strange that you should not have suspected years ago, centuries, ages, and eons ago, for you have existed companionless throughout all the eternities. It is true what I have revealed to you. There is no God, no universe, no human race, no earthly life, no heaven, no hell. It is all a dream, a grotesque and foolish dream. No one who shrinks from Twain's conclusion can be an authentic relativist. Yet everyone must shrink from it to be sane. I know that personally, from a period of clinical depression, when for me there was no meaning to anything or anybody at all. That's the real alternative to cosmos. That is chaos. That's what we have when we deny absolute values. Today, even right and wrong are fading away, as well as good and evil. What is left seems to be healthy and sick, well-adjusted or poorly adjusted, and above all, appropriate and inappropriate. The Holocaust was inappropriate. Stalin was badly adjusted. Only two options are available to us. One is cosmos, The universe has purpose and meaning, and two is chaos. The universe has no purpose or meaning. Well-intentioned people believe that they can create purpose and meaning for themselves, but they have no basis on which to stand. Efforts at explaining away evil and turning it into inappropriate behavior, and therefore socially controllable behavior, have no basis, but they have dangerous effects. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that in the 21st century, geneticists will be able to engineer us away from inappropriate behavior. Wouldn't it be marvelous to engineer people without the ability to rape, or to rob, or to cheat on their taxes, or to disobey the government, or to speak ill of our leaders? Stalin would love it. Or let us suppose that the answer lies in the environment. Let's eliminate drugs, poverty, bad housing. Let's also eliminate bad parents and absentee fathers. Why, we could perfectly destroy the environment of crime by liquidating the places and people who breed it. Well, materialist reductionism and relativism are ethically, well, inappropriate. Equally inappropriate is religious absolutism and exclusivism. The Taliban are not destroying the world's cultural heritage because they're scientific reductionists, but because they are religious absolutists. They're kind of either or. Science has a cleaner moral slate than religion. Scientists can be arrogant, envious, narrow, even hostile, but they do not torture, kill, and war against one another, as adherents of religion have done from the beginning of humanity into the 21st century. Yet, science may not be quite so noble as its most uncritical admirers believe. Science has always needed patrons, and patrons exact their due. The man who takes the king's shilling becomes the king's man. What about the nuclear weapons laboratories in our own university? What about Robert Oppenheimer, who moaned and boasted that he had become Vishnu, destroyer of worlds? What about biochemical warfare labs? And what about all the problems now escaping from Pandora's biological box? The ethical consequences of reductionism on the one hand and religious exclusivism on the other hand are warnings against either-or thinking. But we have an alternative. What if both and thinking constructs a new M-cosmos in the course of this century? Now, one mode of helping do that is that term I used before, and I don't like jargon, even my own, but if anybody has a better term for it, I'd like to hear it. It's what I call metaphorical ontology, and I do need to explain what I mean right away. Ontology, of course, means the study of being in itself, the real ultimate nature of the K-cosmos opening out without limitations in our M-cosmos. Now, metaphor means the transfer of meaning from one statement or image to another. Metaphors can be used to represent features of experience that elude our ordinary literal vocabulary. Metaphors have cognitive significance subject to demonstrations of truth or falsehood. A fish is a Coke machine. It's not a true metaphor. And sometimes metaphors are conceptually autonomous because their truths can be expressed only in metaphor. During the past century, people who are not poets, linguists, or otherwise particularly sensitive to language tended to think of metaphor as nothing but metaphor. Again, reductionist, nothing but, it's just metaphor. But I want to turn the table over. By metaphorical ontology, I mean the construction of an M-cosmos that accurately reflects the K-cosmos. Metaphorical ontology is the use of words denoting one kind of object, action, or idea in place of another in order to suggest a deeper meaning beneath both. When the psalmist says, the author of the psalm says, that the Lord will cover you with his feathers and that you shall trust under his wings, you know that he was not suggesting that you will be a sparrow in a nest. When Jesus called himself a shepherd, he did not mean that he planned sermons for ovine creatures. Metaphorical ontology is the use of figures of speech to go beyond science and history to indicate the deep reality, the divine reality, deep down things. Metaphorical ontology, with its sense of contemplation and wonder, can heal either-or wounds and restore us to wholeness and cosmos. No one ever used metaphorical ontology better than Dante, but that cosmos has been broken. We may prefer the image. We may prefer the image of centering in a special way, centering in the sense of penetrating the core of reality and then opening up through it into the vast multiplicity of reality. Our M cosmos, we're aiming toward that center, but then when we get to the center, it opens up into more and more. Some metaphors point toward the center of reality, others point away, some are serious, others are trivial, and some become so worn over time as become virtually dead. But they can be sorted out, not precisely, but they can be sorted out. Compare these two metaphors about the heavens. One, sit, Jessica, look how the floor is heaven, look how the floor of heaven is thick inlaid with patterns of bright gold. There's not the smallest orb which thou beholdst, but in his notion sings still choiring to the young-eyed cherubims. And two, the stars are dandruff on a blue serge suit. And right on the point of the current discussion, a human being is a machine, or a human being is a living word. Every metaphor is a metaphor, but every metaphor does not point to truth. The proper language of religion is metaphor, and the Bible is usually best opened out metaphorically. Take the passage where King David brings the ark into Jerusalem. What is Jerusalem? It is a city having geographical coordinates and political boundaries. You can go there and visit it. Richard Hecht has lots of times. It has a history. Before David made it his capital, it was a small Jebusite fort. Afterwards, it was part of a succession of kingdoms and empires. Today, it is a source of animosity between Jews and Muslims. But it is also Zion, the land promised eternally to the Jews. It's the place of resurrection for the Jews, the place where Jesus died and rose from the dead, the place where Muhammad ascended into heaven. It is a moral center of the earth. It represents heaven, the soul, the end of the world, and an untellable number of other things. The meaning of Jerusalem is best not narrowed down to any one thing, but rather opened up and expanded, both and more. Traditional scholars believe that the Bible was the Word of God and took great care and consideration with their metaphorical interpretation in the most sincere effort to understand what the God really meant. If we were to say that Jerusalem is God's throne on earth, that is one thing. If we were to say that Jerusalem is really a sweater, something would be going haywire. Metaphorical ontology points to K-cosmos as theophany, the manifestation of the God. And not only words, but phenomena themselves, mental or physical, are metaphors. A redwood tree is not just a redwood tree. It is a manifestation of the immanent God and a metaphor of the God himself. It is beloved, revered, and adored, and it is not to be cut down for any reason short of absolute necessity. Everything that exists is a metaphor for being. Everything is the God's stuff. Deep down, where the darkness of understanding opens endlessly into light, metaphors become reality itself. The theory of metaphorical ontology is not intended to placate reductionists by reducing religion to mere metaphor. Metaphor has inherent cognitive meaning. The new cosmos will not be achieved by the surrender of religion to science any more than the other way around. Metaphorical truth is at least as real as scientific and historical truth. They are languages in which we attempt to reply to the great poet, the great maker. The wonder is all there for us, that there should be anything at all, that we are able to understand anything at all, that the cosmos is delicately balanced so that our existence and our knowledge can be. Can we presume to be able to capture these wonders and pin them like butterflies on a collector's mat? We can construct a new M cosmos where science, history, religion, and art all point together through that center of reality that is truth. But will they converge, Will the search for the ultimate principle that began with the ancient Greeks and passed through Aquinas to Newton to Hawking draw all modes of thought together? Is there one truth that all of us honest people are heading for? I don't know. I used to think so, and it may well be true. But I wonder, what if the center is not a point at all? What if the richness of the cosmos is inexhaustible? What if that truth that we seek turns out to be multiple truths, shimmering, gleaming, beckoning, up, out, in, beyond, into unimagined vistas? Being fully alive entails being fully honest with ourselves. And when we achieve that honesty and that openness of heart and mind that Huxley referred to in the beginning there, a new M cosmos will form itself and delight the K cosmos as well as ourselves. To sum up, K cosmos exists. Our intellectual and moral capacities allow us to construct a new M cosmos. The new M cosmos that may emerge in this century is beautiful beyond hopes, both and more, and still more. And I want to end with something very personal. Years ago, when I felt my own personal cosmos merging into something larger, I was standing on the bluffs above the restless sea in Mendocino, and I wrote, "Cogitation is my history. In ancient stone, I calcified the syllabus of my intent. Sun and shadow limned my lines. I tutored the birds in my vernacular. In my own image and likeness, I made them. For me, seas were symbols merely indenting the coast of my mind with bites of certitude. But the sea stirs, frozen now no longer, and random rain disturbs the brown grass. A wide wind smarting of salt unguides the text that I have boasted on these bluffs. Caves I have not built or seen resound beneath my feet, unfirming the ground with secret syllables. The rippled bay disperses the shadow of my headland. O sea, scour me of syntheses, purge me of parallels, loose my taut grip. The canvas will slacken, it will not fall. Did I think I could bring the waves to my witness, fathom that deep, teach the tide to turn? These geographies do not belong to me. The sea tells its own story." Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now I would like to welcome Helen Kuklelis, Professor of Geography, and Maria Herrera Sobek, Luis Leal Chair in Department of Chicano Studies, who will provide brief comments on Professor Russell's lecture. I'm sorry to say that Joanne Shelton, our third scheduled discussant, had an incident with a horse over the previous weekend. I think it was a horse that had four left feet. And so she will not be with us today, but she does send her regrets. I would also like to inform you that if you have questions you would like to direct to Professor Russell or our two discussants, there are index cards that should be passed around. This is logistically simpler for us. Please write clearly. I will collect them, and we will have a brief question and answer session following the discussants' comments.
Because of my background in engineering, I was asked to make these comments from a perspective, certainly not the perspective of science. Professor Russell spoke very eloquently of two worlds, the K cosmos out there and the M cosmos constructed by the mind and the soul. He ended his lecture with a stunning demonstration of how the two can become merged in human consciousness in transcendent moments of spiritual experience. But for most of us, most of the time, the hard material universe we are part of and our thoughts and hopes and feelings about it are two distinct things. The first is the domain of science, the second the domain of the arts and humanities, ethics, aesthetics, myth, religion, and so on. Philosophy, and in particular epistemology, is the only academically respectable domain of knowledge that has systematically tried to link the two for some 3,000 years now. That there is no final answer after three millennia is not proof of the inadequacy of philosophy, as many have argued, but of the fact that epistemology is after a perpetually moving target. Dr. Russell's historical overview attests to that. Around the middle of the 20th century, the logical positivists came closest to sanctioning the K-cosmos-M-cosmos division in terms that the average working scientist today can accept. For the logical positivists, a statement is scientific if it's either synthetic, that is, derivable from observation through the hypothetico-deductive method of science, which includes rigorous testing, or if it is analytic, that is, derivable from other scientific statements through mathematical manipulations. Roughly, the first of these two conditions supports experimental science and the second, theoretical science. Together, the analytic-synthetic pair defines the line of demarcation between science and non-science, or as some logical positivists have put it, of nonsense. Statements such as God exists, killing is evil, or the cosmos is there for a purpose are neither scientific nor analytic, and therefore they are irreconcilable with science. Never before in the history of human thought have the two been so rigidly separated. There are many problems with that cleavage, however. I will mention just two. The first has to do with the banning from modern natural science of any intimation of teleology. And this has practical consequences. The second has to do with the relationship between mathematics and science and raises some very difficult logical issues that science as we know it cannot deal with. First, a major difference between science and engineering is that modern science rejects teleology, whereas engineering is built on it. Questions pertaining to the purpose of life, the universe, and all that are anathema in science. In engineering, by contrast, every aspect of a design artifact must have a purpose. No part of a car, a missile, or a computer is there just so. The thing with teleology, of course, is that it implies a pre-existing design and therefore a designer. This is not a problem if the designer is Dr. Jones and Company, a scientifically testable fact, but it is a huge problem if the designer has to be some big guy in the sky, a scientifically non-testable fact. In some areas of science, such as evolutionary biology, teleological language is difficult to avoid. Living things try to maximize the survival of their genes and so on. Though biologists, of course, are quick to point out that this is just a manner of speaking and everything can be explained just fine without using the P word, purpose. Natural science tells just so stories, enormously fascinating stories, but without a bottom line. This is fine for ivory tower research, but increasingly, science is demanding a role in human affairs. Unfortunately, the language of policy is teleology, and scientists are at best amateurs at that. So the globe is warming, politicians won't listen, and scientists feel frustrated, and this is largely because the conceptual apparatus of modern science is not designed to cross the positive normative divide. Second problem with the demarcation line. A persistent major unanswered question in science is how come mathematics happens to fit the cosmos as well as it does? There have been several attempts at an answer here. Mathematical structure is part of the universe we study, the K-cosmos. Problem. There is no possible scientific experiment that would help test such a hypothesis. Other answer. Mathematics was created by the human mind in its efforts to understand the universe as observed, an artifact of the M-cosmos. Problem. Then why does mathematics turn out to fit yet undiscovered as well as already observed aspects of the universe? Other kind of answer. God is a mathematician. Do you see a problem with that? The most far-reaching speculation on this issue I have come across is by Sir Arthur Eddington, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist with equally strong credential as an experimentalist and theoretician. In his book, The Philosophy of Physical Science, Eddington writes, "Physical knowledge has the form of a description of the world. We define the physical universe to be the world so described." That's on page 3. The circularity built into this definition implies that the orderly, structured, intelligible universe that science describes is the creation of our mathematical frameworks and conventions of observation and measurement. Take these M-cosmos constructs away, and what is left of the K-cosmos is a random heap of totally unknowable stuff. To sum up, the point of my remarks is that any demarcation line, however defined, between science and non-science, is likely to have big leaky holes in it. There can be no watertight compartments between the fields of human experience. Not necessarily because everything is one, but because to deal with everything, homo cogitans, thinking man, has only one mind. Thank you.
I would like to thank James Proctor for inviting me to present comments on Dr. Russell's lecture. I'm coming from Chicano Studies, but I have a degree in chemistry, a bachelor's degree in chemistry, and I've always wanted to be a philosopher, so I guess that's why I was invited to be here. It is a pleasure and an honor for me to share the podium with such a renowned scholar as Professor Russell. I have admired his books for several years and have used them in some of my own research, particularly the work I'm doing on pastorelas, or shepherd's plays, and the role of the devil in them. And by the way, the devil is always the most popular figure in there. Professor Russell's elucidating presentation is intellectually rich with history and philosophy. He has taken us on a fascinating historical journey regarding science and religion. My function here as a commentator is to bring to the fore some aspects of his lecture that can be particularly useful for discussion. My comments try to problematize some of the issues so brilliantly articulated in Professor Russell's lecture. In Professor Russell's lecture, I detect an extreme desire to believe there is a purpose and an order to the cosmos. This desire for the existence of a transcendental being is, of course, quite common in people and can be found throughout the world in all races and cultures, as is evident in the multiplicity of organized religions past and present. Scientists have studied the universality of the religious experience and have come up with some startling conclusions. Recently, there was a lecture in Santa Barbara by Dr. Andrew Newberg, which perhaps some of you went to, a research physician from Harvard who spoke on the subject of brain chemistry and religious belief. According to the Santa Barbara News Press, Dr. Newberg just published a book titled Why God Wouldn't Go Away, Brain Science and the Biology of Belief. Dr. Newberg arrives at very similar conclusions as Dr. Russell. In Newberg's scientific strategies for religious scientific research takes the path of, quote, down the middle, respecting, quote, both the religious and scientific perspectives on the world. He further states that according to brain research undertaken at Harvard, he and his collaborators have found that, quote, our brain is set up in such a way that God tends to be there, end of quote. Nevertheless, a problem I see with the schemata of the cosmos Professor Russell has posited is that his views on the cosmos tend to be couched in binary oppositional terms, i.e., the K-cosmos represented order and purpose versus chaos represented disorder and a purposeless universe. The problem that surfaces for those of us who are deity challenged is that it questions our ability to function morally and ethically without religion or a belief in the God. This also brings out the question of whose religion should we take seriously, and most importantly, when it comes to moral absolutes, whose moral absolutes should we follow? Decent people differ on questions of what constitutes evil. Such issues as abortion, the death penalty, euthanasia, and embryonic stem cell experimentation, to name a few, are not easy to agree regarding whether they are evil or not. Holland, for example, has recently legalized euthanasia. If we look at the history of religions, we are confronted with a catalog of evils, in quotes, organized religions have committed in the name of God, as Professor Russell so eloquently pointed out. And as he has underscored, science has been equally guilty of atrocities such as undertaking human experiments without proper consent. Professor Walter Cohn, in last week's lecture, pointed out how difficult it must be for Catholics to be Catholics because they are directed to believe in the infallibility of the Pope. I agree with him. It is difficult to be a Catholic, but it is equally difficult to belong to any other religion because upon close analysis, all have their own individual quirks which make us question them. It seems to me that one route available to us is to keep a healthy dose of skepticism and to question authority, both in science and religion. Perhaps in this manner, we can achieve the M-cosmos so ardently desired by Professor Russell. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Professors Sobeck and Kuklelis for their astute comments. The philosophy behind this lecture series is one of dialogue. Dialogue, I think all three of you exemplified, both in your presentations and certainly is exemplified in the conversation between them. We would like to invite you as well to participate in this dialogue. Due to time constraints, I may not be able to use all of the questions that are up here, but we will have a general reception afterward, and I invite you to speak with Jeffrey, Helen, or Maria. So, can we ask you a few questions? And I will presume Jeffrey gets first crack at most of these, but certainly Helen and Maria, please chip in as well. What is your account for why the science-religion cleavage is so deep in the academy today?
I think the answer is, I can think immediately of two answers. That's a very deep question. First, of course, is the history of science and of religion that I went romping through so quickly that it was terrifying. I have My original draft of the lecture was 150 pages, and I thought, well, this probably isn't going to go over well with the audience. So I keep cutting things out. So my historical survey was very, very rapid. But it's partly, of course, it's historical. And partly it has to do also with the structure of the modern university, where we have divisions in the departments which have become, the divisions have become clearer and clearer. If you look at the syllabus for undergraduates from any major university at the beginning of the past century, that is around 1900, you'll find an amazing coherence in the curriculum that all students are supposed to study, mathematics and languages and natural science and history and so forth. It's a very coherent program. And even when I first started teaching in the in 1960 actually, there was still a great trace of that left. But everybody was supposed to know certain basic things about the basic disciplines. But in the process of the course of the last century, it seems to me there's this increasing desire to divide ourselves into specialties. And partly it's because there's so much more knowledge. None of us can be Aristotle anymore. We can't know something about everything. There's simply too much to know. So in a part it's natural, but it's become too difficult. It's become the boundaries have become too hard. And we hardly ever speak to each other on campus. You know how difficult it is for people in one department to discuss things with another. I mean, Helen and I used to be in the same building, and now we aren't anymore, and we're spread all over the campus. So I think it's partly the division, both physically in terms of our separation from each other and in terms of our specialization, that that there's not enough of this kind of dialogue, not enough, that the dialectic is kind of lost. And programs such as this one, the Templeton lectures that Jim is so ably organized, it seems to me that will help. And I don't think we can get to a good new e-cosmos in this century, the 21st century, unless we start talking to each other a great deal more than we have been.
If I may add something, I have thought about this, and it seems to me that the profound cleavage between science and religion is part of an even more profound cleavage that is part of the modernist program of the 19th, 20th centuries. And this is the opposition between fact and value, objective and subjective, normative, positive and normative, and on and on. There are all kinds of pairs like that that permeates many aspects of our thinking, even beyond the two subjects we're talking about.
Well, I would bring it more home to the 1960s, when my generation started really questioning everything. And I think there was a great loss of belief in institutions. And the loss then of institution in religion and in science both came about. And I think in a sense, what I'm seeing now with the younger generation, with our current students, it seems that they're kind of turning back to religion, which is kind of exciting in a way. But I think that 60s was a period of great questioning and cleavage in that sense, in getting away from questioning both institutions, both religion and religious institutions and scientific institutions.
Thank you. Here's another question. Why is it assumed that materialistic explanation of the cosmos excludes ethics? If everything is materially connected, doesn't that mean that our survival is dependent on that interconnectedness? Couldn't that be a source of ethics?
Well, again, a very good and a deep question. And there are, of course, many philosophical ethicists who are trying to build, and I don't know enough about the subject to say how well, but I know they're trying to build systems of ethics based upon non-transcendent suppositions. But it seems to me, and I'm not sure I'm getting quite at the point of the question, it does seem to me that that the biological survival of the species, or even development of the species, if you like, may not have any need in itself for ethics, as some of these reductionists are pointing out. I mean, they shrink from it. Stephen Jay Gould, who I respect very much personally, and in his work as well, you know, has said we need both science and religion. And what science does is tell us about reality, and what religion does is tell us about how we ought to behave. And if we could define religion in the way he's using it, we could include philosophy. I mean, I think he means philosophy, ethics that aren't necessarily based on the God. But I just wonder if that's going to work. I mean, Maria referred to the insensitivity of politicians, or actually all the people who are actually running things while we sit here talking. And I'm really afraid. God knows, I hope that Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot and people like that are not going to reoccur in the future, but I don't see any real historical reason to say that they wouldn't. And then, who's going to say which are the ethically right things to do? And maybe it's right to genetically engineer people who are all tall and blonde and will salute the Führer. Who decides these things? It's a very complicated question. But I think we all end up intrinsically. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould, you know, he's a very, very he's very proud, as he ought to be, of his distinction in biology and what he's accomplished. And I don't think that he would. I don't think when pressed, I tried to press him once, and I didn't get a response. That he would really believe that ethics are simply something that we need to get along biologically, because I'm not sure that we do need them. Anyway, that's kind of rambling. I'm sorry, Helen or Maria.
I would just like to reiterate what Dr. Russell just said. As biological beings, we don't need ethics any more than snails need ethics or plants need ethics. I mean, they all survive just fine without ethics. Why do we need ethics of all species?
Well, I'm speechless. when I began questioning God, and actually it was in the 60s, you know, when I started college and I started reading about all the atrocities the popes had done, because I was a Catholic, and then of course I started not believing in the Catholic Church, and then of course I started to look into the Protestant Church, but I found the Protestant Church was really racist. You know, the churches were all segregated, and I just couldn't really stomach the Protestant Church. So then, you know, how then do you construct an ethical system? Because I believe I'm a very ethical person. I hope I am. And so, you know, that's the question that you have to ask yourself. And for me, it was, you know, if we are orphans from God, you know, if indeed we have been left alone in this earth, then it's just each of us. We only have each other. And so we just have to take care of each other, just like orphans would take care of each other if they don't have parents. So if we don't have a parent, we just have to take care of each other. And that's the way I have constructed my ethical system. It's, I guess, the humanist ethical system.
Thank you. One final question. This one's quite provocative. Walter Cohn commented last week that the 20th century was the most glorious in the history of science and perhaps the most dismal in the history of humanity. In light of the fact that the Nazis and Marxists are proponents of materialist reductionism, aren't the atrocities of this ersatz religion at least as horrendous as the atrocities of traditional religions? Are those scientists who promote materialist reductionism advocating anything with a cleaner slate than religion?
Wow, okay. Wonderful questions. In a way, I, in fact, in most ways, I agree with Ninian Smart, who is here with us spiritually today, that Nazism and Marxism, for example, are religions. That is, they're based upon faith assumptions about things. And so one could say, well, look, okay, since Marxism and Nazism are religions and they have perpetrated atrocities, therefore, again, this is simply more evidence that religions perpetrate atrocities. Can reductionists perpetrate atrocities? Yeah, I think they can. I think they can. I think the result of saying that there is no purpose or meaning, the result can lead us to, the result of that thought can lead us to say, okay, then we are entitled to manipulate other people and the entire cosmos, anything we get our hands on, to suit our own desires and wishes. And as an historian, I fear where that can lead us. I mean, it's led us there before, and, you know, God, however you want to define him, her, or them, help us when that happens.
I think you should have the final word.
Yes. Now they're both speechless. Thank you very much to Professor Russell and to all participants in today's event. Please feel free to join us outside in a general reception, and please help spread the word about the upcoming two lectures, Freeman Dyson on May 18th and Alan Wallace on June 1st. Thank you very much.
Although time ran out at Dr. Russell's lecture, questions remained. It's a pleasure to have him here in the studio with us today to wrap up this segment of Science, Religion, and the Human Experience. Dr. Russell, my first question is this. Francis Bacon referred to God's two books, Revelation and Creation. Did the geocentric universe develop from biblical revelation or from reason and observation?
Basically, the Bible doesn't have much to say about that question. The general assumption that the Earth, rather than the Sun, is at the center of the universe is not a biblical idea or a religious idea. It springs from natural reason and observation and was held by every culture that we know about just from the appearance of things. It's a perfectly natural thing to assume, and people assume that simply from what they had observed. So it's more of a scientific statement that the Earth is at the center of the universe. It's more of an observational statement, in that sense scientific, than it is a religious statement.
Okay, so in other words, the conflict is not between religion and science, but between what might have been an earlier science and a later scientific model.
Right, between two different scientific models, or as they would have put it then, two different models of natural philosophy, rather than religion versus science. Yes, absolutely.
Is the myth of the flat earth a good example of scientific enlightenment dispelling religious mythology?
That's an interesting question, because the question is where the mythology lies there. In fact, no educated person from the time of the ancient Greeks to the present has believed that the Earth was flat. And every historian of science, anybody who knows anything about the subject, knows that and has written about it. There are still a few popular books out there that talk about in the Middle Ages, people thought the Earth was flat. It's absolute nonsense. Educated people knew perfectly well that the Earth was round. So the question is, where do we have this persistent, idea that people used to think that the Earth was flat and that somehow Columbus proved it was round? That is the myth. The mythology is not the belief in the flat Earth, which never existed. The mythology is the idea that people used to believe that the Earth was flat. Well, what kind of mythology is it? It certainly is not religious mythology. It is it is a anti-Christian mythology. The idea seems to have developed from the 18th century from Thomas Paine and his anti-Christian writings. And the idea was simply to say, look, Christians are so stupid. Look what they believe. In the Middle Ages, they all thought that the Earth was flat, which isn't true at all. It was something that Tom Paine threw out there as part of his propaganda. And then it got picked up. You see, it got picked up in the mid-19th century got picked up by the Darwinists as a weapon to attack the anti-Darwinists. As we all know, many of the anti-Darwinists were Christians, and so the Darwinists said, "Look how stupid these people are with their objection to Darwinian evolution. They're just as stupid as the Christians back in the Middle Ages who argued that the Earth was flat." That was a very compelling argument. They used it all the time, except that people didn't believe that the Earth was flat in the Middle Ages. So here we have an example of an anti-religious myth rather than a religious myth.
Could you draw the distinction between science and scientism?
There's a great difference between science and scientism. And science is, as far as I can see, a wholly good thing. What science does properly is to investigate the natural properties of the physical universe to the best of its abilities, using mathematics and observation and reason, and to tell us the way physical things work and why they work that way, how they work. It's entirely a good thing. Scientism is something different. Scientism, in my view, is a kind of religion, because what scientism operates not on the basis of observation, but on the basis of a fundamental act of faith. That act of faith is that science is the only way to discover the truth, and that the truth is entirely material, that we can explain everything scientifically because everything is material and thus subject to scientific questions. Well, that's a highly questionable act of faith, but whether one likes it or not, it is an act of faith. It is a ideological and, I think, in a way, a religious statement in itself. And we find some scientistic, materialistic thinkers saying right out, we cannot admit, right from the beginning, we cannot admit that there is any other kind of truth than the truth which, than material truth which science can investigate. There is no other truth. And that, of course, puts aside not only religion, but it puts aside poetry and art and the very aspect of everyday life where we experience things quite differently. So scientism is, whether it's a bad thing or a good thing, scientism is an act of faith. It's a religious statement, as opposed to science, which is a wonderful way of investigating the material universe.
In essence, what you're saying is that Francis Bacon's two books, Revelation and Creation, have been reduced to only one book, and that is The Cosmos.
Yes.
And that book had no author.
Yes, that would be the scientific position that ultimate reality is material. There is no mind, no purpose, no idea. It simply is there. There's no reason for it. There's no reason in it. There's no purpose for it. Everything is in effect pointless and meaningless and without purpose.
Here at the beginning of the third millennium, is it more reasonable to believe in an eternal cosmos or an eternal creator of that cosmos?
Well, it is partly a scientific question. Scientific evidence, of course, now is extremely strong, overpoweringly, that the universe did have a beginning. And scientists, physicists are pretty well convinced that we'll have an end, too, whether it ends in complete entropy or whether it in fact does reverse and return to an infinitely dense point is still open. But that it had a beginning, I don't think anybody with any scientific knowledge questions. So if it had a beginning, then where does it come from? Does it come from itself, or does it come from some kind of creator? Now, our observations from the world is that things don't come from nothing. We have no experience of anything coming from nothing. So it does seem philosophically more likely that there is a creator than that the cosmos itself is somehow it's created itself.